Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about what's actually happening in practice. And I think something that may be a secret to some but is well known to many folks in assessment is that the Canadians, in general, are doing a great job. In fact, way better, I think, than what we are doing here in the U.S. in many aspects. They have different laws and different abilities to do things. You will find that the assessment programs are generally, not always, but generally linked with the licensing body, so they are able to do some more things. The next two speakers are going to be Andre Jacques and Bill McCauley. Both of them are involved with assessment programs in Quebec and Ontario. And first, we're going to hear from Andre. And just as another introduction for Andre Jacques, he is the director of the, please bear with my French here, Collège de Médecine de Québec. Okay. And so, thank you. So Andre is going to share some of the experiences of the assessments that they are actually already doing on aging physicians.
Thank you, David. We will switch gear a little bit. I agree with Dr. Miller, most of the thing, but there's always two sides to a coin, and I think this will be the other side of the coin. As David said, I'm coming from Quebec, and the presentation will be in French. I'm kidding. Just to start, I want to thank my colleagues. We're five from the Quebec College here, and there will be two other presentations on the same topic. And I want to thank all my colleagues, and especially Marc Biard, who is my associate director, who pulled all the data together to present to prepare this presentation. I have no conflict of interest, except I'm a full-time physician for 18 years working at a college, so I have a little bias there. Let's see what's going on in Quebec as manpower. This is the distribution of family docs and specialists in the Quebec and, as April 2011. And that's a normal distribution, I think, everywhere in Canada. But look at that little part on this side. This is people, family doc and specialists, working over 65 and 90 years old. So that's concern our college. If you look closely to those over 70, family docs and specialists, there's a lot of people there, more than 1,000 physicians. I'll put my glasses, it will be easier for my eyes. Sorry. It's a big concern for us, too, because we don't know exactly what are doing those physicians. For sure, they are doing well, but we're not sure. If you look at the trend, only the last 2 years, this is an increase of that. And you can imagine all the cause of that, you know, all the economics problems and other problems. So they're coming older and older. So the board, because we're a licensing body, we just run by the fee of physicians, no governmental input. So we were bringing that problem from the board and from our peer review committee. That's more than 2,111 physicians over 65. They are increasing number over 60 and 65. And as anybody said, the literature are there for some part. So we decide to look our data. It's a retrospective stuff. I will not link anything to literature because my colleagues before me done a well done job. So we look our data for the last 10 years. We do 1,618 peer review on the ground. That was done by a full-time inspector, we call that in Quebec. You are doing in office, in hospital, in operating room, assessment of those physicians. There were 16 people for the last 10 years. We do about 165 peer review per year. We do also review a hospital, and we test or examine the quality of the practitioner in those hospitals. But this 165 was only individual that we peer reviewed themselves. We use 70 experts per year. That's mean 43% of the peer assessment was done by two physicians, one inspector who is the expert of process, and one expert of content. And also we can have access to all the data that's coming from the government, billing data, prescribing data. So sometimes we use that data to also to have a picture of the outcome of the physicians. We don't do any random or very small amount of random assessment. We do that on risk factor. As Dr. Miller said, age is only one of the factor. You have a list of different factors that we can use during the last 10 years. And then we look also our... So this retrospective study is all those visits done in the last 10 years. If we focus on those physicians who are over 70, what was the outcomes of that? So the first thing we have to put forward is when we announce a visit, we don't knock at the door in the morning. Hello, you're lucky we're coming this morning. That's not the way it is. 2-3 months before, we send a questionnaire, about 20 pages, about what are you doing, what kind of practice, what number of visit you, et cetera, et cetera. So we build our peer review team with the content of the practice that physicians already send us. But sometimes we just announce the visit, and the physician said, no, no, don't come. Don't come. I'm retiring. Okay. So maybe that's a little bit of insight. We hope. So we have the figure. 55% of the 304 visit that was canceled, that was normally be done, was done by retirement for the physicians. So what were the results? First, I'll give you a little color code for understanding the next slides. So there's five level of when we come at after the peer review of the we presented this to the peer review committee, and after we have four kind of things. The first one is cancellation. Yeah, like I just explained that before. But the level zero, the blue one, is fine. No action is, you know, sometimes we send satisfaction letter to the physician. You're doing good work. Thank you very much. Continue. We maybe come back in 5 years or something like that. The level one is a green color. You're okay, but you need some improvement in some little part of your practice. So we send him some recommendation. Could be 2, 3, 5, could be 20. And that's it. We will come back maybe. The level two is the yellow part, is the peer review committee has concerns, but yes, we can send you some recommendation, but we will come back. And if the concerns are very high, we maybe come back in 3 months or 6 months. If the concern is not so high, we can come back in 1 year or 2 years. But there's a little control visit to be done. And level three is those who are very in deep problem because they need more intense interventions, retraining, limitation of their practice, or maybe think about retirement seriously, or some courses that you have to do it. So if you're 2 and 3, you're in trouble. If you're 1 and 2, 1 and 0, you're okay. So for the last 10 years, if you do look at that by age, you can see more green and blue for the first part. But if you go at the end, oops, sorry. If you go at the 70 and 75 and to 99, there's a lot of cancellation. That's the this one. a lot of gray, a lot of red and yellow compared to the other one. If you focus more on the over 65, you can see that the more 70 and 75 are in more maybe more in trouble. 31% of level 3 for 70 and over, and 37% of cancellation 75 and over, and 21% of level 3. So there's a lot of concern about their quality of practice. And that was done by on-site visit, chart review, chart stimulated recall. Could be in the operating room. It could be anywhere you practice. If you practice in 2-3 settings, we go over the 2-3 setting. If you look at those of 80 and over, the first part of the slide, you can see that some have visits, less than 5 years or more than 5 years, but 53% of them have no visit yet. And if you see on the other part of the graph, 36% earn $100,000 and more. That's not a slight practice. This for Quebec is a heavy practice. Maybe not in the state, but if you look at the control visit, so we have concern, we give some cue and some help to remediate their problems, and we visit them after. As you can see, compared to the two groups, the 70 years old and over 70, there's a lot of red, I think is this part, 25% still have a big problem compared to those younger physicians. CPD. So if you have a good CPD record, meaning that not only in quantity but in quality, because we survey a cardiologist who was a senior one, and he has a lot of CME activities, but in fact he was attached to the big university hospital when he was younger, and have all his CPD after he left the big hospital to do in private practice, who was doing general practice cardiology, but in fact he goes, all CME activities was going to the tertiary care university activities, and in fact was very good in stent and all those things, but in his own office doesn't use anything of that knowledge. So there's a link there for CPD. If you have not a good CPD, you see the red is much more greater and the yellow too. So there's a link there between CPD. That's not only for 70 years old physician, that's for all the physician. But if you look with the age, the not good CPD is the red color. You see that's over 65. The number of physicians who are not keeping updating their knowledge are more higher than the other one. Now, if we put them in retraining, because by regulation we can mandate those physicians to have some retraining. It could be full-time, could be half-time, could be with limitation of their practice or not. Could be focused on one thing or hold their practice. If you look at the result after the training, that was not very good for those physicians over 60. There's a 9% failure, but you look at the retirement part after the retraining, because they have to pay that retraining. Imagine if you're 75 years old and you're going in retraining session with younger physicians, you're not updating really your knowledge. It's a lot of the scale is very high to achieve. So after the retraining, maybe you say, okay, I have enough, I will retire. So discussions now. Many physicians reflect on their practice at that time of the announcement of the provincial inspection visit or the peer review visit. Age becoming an important risk factor for us. We cannot visit all, even if I have I have six, now seven full-time physicians doing inspection. I have a 24 staff person running all those things with a big bunch of the budget of the college. But we cannot assess all those physicians because there's other problems we can look at. So, and also the fact that a small percentage of success after a clinical training program for those. What can we do? Should we encourage these to think about their future, have a graceful exit, less traumatic, and at the right time? Should we encourage them to retire, who avoid a clinical training program doomed to failure, or to protect the public against incomplete or inadequate practice, or becoming other stuff like mentoring or focusing their practice, retraining, as we said before, in under their field. Thank you.
It is my pleasure now to introduce Bill McCauley, who is the current president of CPE, the Coalition of Physician Enhancement. In addition, he is the medical advisor for the Quality Management Program for the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, and again is going to give the perspective from Ontario. For those of you that know Bill, you'll notice that he is sporting a little facial hair at this visit. It is to celebrate Movember, which is to recognize prostate cancer awareness. So he's growing a mustache this month for prostate cancer awareness. Bill.
Thanks, Dave. I think that before I get started, I just want to, as president of CPE, this is my only opportunity to take the mic, so I just wanted to thank the organizers of this program. The program's been organized entirely by Dave Bazo and his staff, which consists of Bill Norcross, Peter Bowl, the PACE Katies, of which there are two, I think, and who am I missing? Oh, Sabrina Bazo, Dave's wife. They have worked to design this program for you, to bring it to you. I've been incredibly impressed on the flow of the program, so how they have started with some very basic concepts and worked through some conceptual stuff, and now we're getting into more practical things. I think it's brilliant. I just want everyone to recognize them now, if you wouldn't mind. And the presenters have been phenomenal. That's all about to change now that I'm up here. But you have to understand that, I'm happy to learn this from Dr. Jesty, that I'm 49 years old. So according to him, I am scraping the bottom of the barrel of my life right now, trying to get by day to day. But things are looking up. So here we go. So the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, I'm going to be spending some time giving you a little bit of background stuff because I know there are a lot of people in the crowd that are unfamiliar with many of our organizations. So you're going to have to bear with me, those of you who do know a little bit about us. But we're essentially the provincial equivalent to the state medical board, sort of. We do many of the things that most state medical boards do, but I think as someone else pointed out, in addition to regulation, we also have a huge quality assurance mandate. So we do a lot of physician education. Unlike the American model, where if you need a physician to be assessed, typically you'll send them to a great organization like PACE or CPEP in Denver or the K-STAR program in Texas for assessment of their abilities, we tend to do it ourselves in Canada. So we've got a whole division of the college that does assessments. Ontario is a big province. It's got a population of 13 million. As I say, it's big. It's really big. It is the greenish yellow province in Canada, right beside Quebec, which is much bigger. And though we're right beside each other, but we couldn't be more different. Andre would probably say I speak kind of funny, but we have 30,000 actively practicing physicians in Ontario that we regulate. The majority of the population base is right at the very bottom. If you look, I don't have a laser pointer, but right, oh, yes, I do. Right there, that's the major of the population base. Up here, there's a whole lot of nothing. So, we do a lot of different assessments, and our college is divided into two halves. There's a quality management side and the investigation side, investigations and resolutions. So the quality management division does a lot of different assessments for different reasons. We do peer assessments, and we're going to talk a lot about that. We've been doing them since 1979. We do assessments for registration. So if you meet our registration standards, we give you a license. If you don't meet them, then in certain situations, we will give you a restricted practice certificate. So you can practice under supervision, and at the end of a year, typically, then you you have an assessment done by the college. We've got the PrEP program, which is our high-stakes assessment for family physicians, and the equivalent to that for specialists is called the Specialties Assessment Program. We also assess premises, so out-of-hospital premises and independent health facilities. They're slightly different, but they're essentially when physicians are working outside of a hospital environment. And then if you, in order to prescribe methadone in Ontario, you have to have a special license to do that, and we assess methadone prescribers as well. Interestingly, just a little sidebar comment, we did a study looking at deaths related to methadone, and when we started to assess methadone prescribers, the deaths related to use of methadone dropped dramatically in our province. So the investigations and resolution side, that's where the public complaints or the hospital complaints towards physicians investigations take place. And obviously we do assessments that are related to complaints. We will do inspections of a physician's practice when that is necessary. The registrar, who is the head of the college, might get notified by a hospital about a physician's privileges, for example, and the registrar might do an investigation of that physician's practice. And then we also have something on that side of the college called a comprehensive practice assessment. And that's when a physician comes to our attention from a public complaint and we need to do an in-depth assessment of their practice. That's what we do. It's very similar to that SAP or the Specialties Assessment Program that we do. So by the end of this talk, we're going to look at both of those areas. And what I hope that you take away from it is a little bit of an understanding of how physicians who are over and under the age of 70 are performing, both when they come to our attention through a quality assurance assessment process or when they come to us as a result of a public complaint. So a little bit of history on the peer assessment program. We've been doing it a long time, and our peer assessment program is a little bit different than that of Quebec's. It was conceived of in 1977, and the pilot started in 1978 to 79. And the reason, the objectives of the program back then was very much a search and destroy mission. Okay, so the reason for the peer assessment program back then was to identify physicians who are practicing at an unacceptable level, to be able to provide educational recommendations, and then to ensure that those educational activities had an effective outcome. There's an article that I'm going to refer to by Robert McCauley, different spelling, not related, from 1990 that looks at the results of the program from 1981 for the first 5 years. So I'm just going to go over that. And I just realized I don't have a slide on what we actually do in a peer assessment. In a peer assessment, there are a number of components. You are sent a questionnaire that gives us information about your practice. We match a peer to your practice and send a peer in who does a couple of things. The peer will meet with you and talk to you and talk to you about that questionnaire and find a bit more about your practice. The peer will take a look at your office and your facilities and look at some physical things about your practice. And then the peer will go through 20 to 30 randomly selected charts in order to make comments on both your documentation and your care. And then obviously we'll discuss that with the physician afterwards. So that's what a peer assessment involves. It's not comprehensive. It's meant to be a bit of a screen more than anything. The first 5 years, we assessed 923 physicians. 663, or 62% of those, were family docs or GPs. This chart you can refer to in your syllabus. I won't spend a lot of time on charts because they're hard to look at, but it just basically shows that 663 were family docs. The next biggest groups involved were internists and psychiatrists, and then there's a smattering of surgeons in there. So overall, if you look at the 918 of these docs that were assessed, you see that around 11% had grossly deficient records or unsatisfactory level of care. 82% had no problems whatsoever, and 7% had deficient records but no deficiencies in care. That's reasonably representative of what we've seen since we started doing this in 1979. Year after year, generally, about 85% of docs have no problems. About 10% of docs have got problems that are related only to record keeping, and about 5% of docs have problems that are related to the care that they're providing. When you looked at those docs, this is the family doctors, and you break down a few different factors. You see that if you are over the age of 75, you are much more likely as a family physician to have difficulties grossly deficient records or clinical care. You'll see that 35% of docs over the age of 75 from this cohort, from 81 to 86, had significant difficulties, versus if you're under the age of 50, only 9%. So you'll see that's quite a striking difference in the numbers. The other thing that came out, and this has already come out from other speakers, is that if you are a member of the College of Family Physicians of Canada, that's the Canadian specialty society. If you are not a member, then 18% of those docs during that time had grossly deficient records or unsatisfactory care. But if you are a certificant, meaning that you are a member and you pass the exams and are continuing to comply with their requirements of being a member, then you only had a 3% chance of having grossly deficient issues. And finally, the type of practice, solo practice, 17% versus not solo practice, 9%. So that was also a very significant difference. So these are some of the other issues that contribute to physicians performing poorly. One of the other things, this isn't related to age, but we have since that time, since this study was done, used quality of records as a little bit of a surrogate or a marker for clinical care. And this is the data that helps us to do that. And that's that there's only four docs out of 519 docs that had had satisfactory records but unsatisfactory care. Okay, so the vast majority of docs who've got satisfactory records are providing good care. The opposite isn't true. If you've got unsatisfactory records, that's not a direct line to providing unsatisfactory care. There's lots of us that whose records could use work, but that doesn't mean that we're not providing good care. Okay, but so we can use it as a bit of a screen. Good records, you're probably providing good care. So our current peer assessment program, although what we do is similar, the approach to it and the culture of it is quite different. We look at it as an educational program, as an opportunity to provide feedback to physicians in practice on their care. And from time to time when we do that, we find docs that that have got some difficulties that we need to address. We're doing about 1,400 per year now, so we've really ramped up the numbers that we're doing, and we're hoping to get more than that. Our goal is ultimately to assess every doc every 10 years. We're not there yet. As a result of the age-related data that I showed you earlier, the only targeting that we do is for docs that are age 70 and over. So if you are age 70, once you hit age 70, we assess you every 5 years. Other than that, you get your name gets electronically drawn out of a hat, and you have random assessments done. Okay, so what I did for this presentation is we pulled the data from 2005 to 2009 to compare docs less than age 70 who are at age 70 and who are greater than age 70. So those are the numbers that were done. You can see that in the late 2000s we were making efforts to increase the number of assessments that we do quite significantly. So this represents over 4,000 assessments over 5 years. About 60% of those were age less than 70. We categorize our peer assessments or the outcomes of our peer assessment in three different levels. Category one, there's no problem. Bob's your uncle. Off to the races. Category two, there are some issues, but they're generally just record-keeping issues, and that represents that sort of 10% that I've been talking about earlier. And category three is that there are some care concerns or there's significant record-keeping deficiencies. And generally when that happens, we go on and do a little bit more digging and do a more comprehensive assessment. So here are the results. This is probably the most important slide in terms of the peer assessment data. You'll see that the red bars are the age less than 70. The gold bars on the other end are the physicians who are greater than 70. And the green bars are those that are exactly 70 years old. So you'll see that in the category three, these are the docs that have got concerns with their care or grossly deficient records. 9% of docs who are over the age of 70 have got problems versus only 3.2% in that younger age category. So we think that this is reasonably good objective evidence that docs, once they get older, are performing a little bit more poorly on our peer assessment anyway. I've just got three slides here just showing you that that over time that hasn't really changed. So for the docs less than 70, the numbers are pretty much the same in every category in every year. There's a little bit of a blip in the age 70 group for the category threes. I'm not sure why that is. And then for the docs age 70 or over 70, again, it's fairly consistent year over year that the numbers that we see in the categories are similar. I also just looked quickly at our PrEP and SAP, our high-stakes assessment data. So our PrEP assessment program, which was referred to earlier, is a high-stakes assessment or what we call a level 3 assessment for docs that have been identified as potentially having concerns. So none of these are random. These are, okay, there's a problem. We have to send you off for a higher-level assessment. If you're a family doc, you go to PrEP. If you're a specialist, you go to SAP. The PrEP consists of an intake questionnaire like we do with peer. There's a multiple-choice question exam, 6 standardized patient scenarios that you're put through, and a chart-stimulated recall, which is a chart review with direct interaction with the reviewer, where you can get a sense of clinical decision-making, rationale, and reason for treatment and that sort of thing. It's a nice tool. The SAP, we don't have the multiple-choice question battery, unfortunately, for all the different specialists, so we just immerse ourselves in that doctor's practice for usually up to 3 days at a time, where you will review records, you will observe physicians interviewing patients, examining patients, operating on patients. You will interview stakeholders that work with you or who are impacted by your work in some way, and we do patient surveys based on the PAR program from Alberta and gather all that information back together in order to assign you a category. And the categories are 1 through 5 in this high-stakes assessment program. Category 1 is no or minimal deficiency. Everything is great. Category 5 is an ominous-sounding critical deficiency, immediate risk or threat to patient safety. And so these are the categories that are assigned. In the PrEP, it's actually assigned by a computer. And in the SAP, it's not assigned by a computer, but it's assigned by the assessor and the committee who make judgment. This represents 35 PrEPs and SAPs over a 2-year period. So it's not we're not doing huge numbers of these, but you can see from all physicians the average score is 3.36. If you're less than age 55, it's 3. That sort of makes sense. Remember, these are pre-screened docs, that there's likely to be some problems. If you're over age 70, 3.42. So you do poorly. Interestingly, but really not that interestingly, if you're 55 to 69, you tend to do worse than the docs over age 70. And I think that the reason for that is that there's been a filter applied here. And the filter that's been applied is that if you're over the age of 70 and you've been assessed by the college and there's some concerns and we want to take you through a PrEP or an SAP, there's a reasonable likelihood that you'll make the choice to put on a fisherman's hat and head to the dock and retire. And so many of these docs over age of 70, and we sit down with these docs and their lawyers and talk to them about what the best approach. We bring our data from our studies that have been referred to about performance at PrEP in elderly physicians and the likelihood of successive remediation. We talk to them about the cost of remediation, which can get in the tens of thousands of dollars, and very often these docs will choose to retire. That's less likely to happen at the age of 55 to 69 when people are still actively earning an income. So I think that's the reason for that. I haven't dug deeply into the data, but I'm surmising that that's likely the case. So the observations that I would make with respect to looking at this data is that compared to their younger colleagues, physicians 70 and older more frequently have serious record-keeping deficiencies and more frequently have care concerns. That's for the peer data. And that once identified as having specific concerns, physicians older than age 55 perform significantly more poorly than those less than age 55. And that if you're greater than 70, that may not be much worse or maybe even better than those 55 to 69. But again, there's been a filter applied there. Okay. What about public complaints? And we haven't talked much about this. As a regulator, a lot of what we do is discipline. So we pulled the complaints data from 2005 to 2011. And the data that I'm going to present to you represents 8,030 completed investigations that have been coded. During that time, there were 15,150 complaints against physicians in the province of Ontario. At the time that I had this data pulled a few weeks ago, We had complete data on 8,030 of them, meaning the complaint file was closed. Not only closed, but all of the data with respect to that had been entered into our database. So because of that, you should also be aware that this data is probably skewed a little bit towards those earlier years, because it's more likely that complaints from 2005 are going to be completed and coded than from those that have taken place in 2011. And we're also going to look, for the most part, at those complaints where something came of it. So there's been a committee action. The complaints committee, or what's now called ICRC, has looked at the complaint and decided you have to do something, or you're going somewhere, or something is going to happen. That represents 26% of those 8,030, or 2,000 complaints. And we're going to look at some graphs looking at all these things. We're not going to talk about when the committee has looked at the complaint and have taken no action. That happened about 35% of the time. We're not going to look significantly, I'll show you a couple of graphs about these, but we're not going to look significantly at when the department, meaning the Investigations and Resolutions Department, has closed a case or resolved a case. So the difference between those two is that when there's a complaint, there's an investigator that's assigned to it, and the investigator will speak with the complainant and will speak with the physician, and very often some sort of resolution can come, maybe an acknowledgement of there being a problem, an apology. Something happens at the staff level that allows us to, the complainant says, yes, we can close this file. A departmental closure is when the department closes the complaint for a number of reasons. The complainant decides to drop it. They don't want to move on. The complainant maybe doesn't understand what the complaint process is all about, and it's called the college because they want money. And we'd say, no, go sue the doctor. Don't come to us if you want money. So there, those would be reasons that a file would be closed. Just also by background, when complaints have been resolved or closed by a committee, they're assigned into three main categories. So the issues that the complaint were either clinical, conduct, or capacity issues. Now, often there's more than one, but in general, there's a main issue to these things. And in the clinical issues, they are related to treatment. That typically means currency of treatment. They might be related to substandard documentation, consent issues, prescribing of just general prescribing and prescribing of narcotics, and to improper diagnosis. Similarly, there are subcategories for conduct and capacity. So we will be looking a little bit at each of these things when I show you the data. And finally, the actions that our complaints committee can do is they can refer you for an incapacity hearing if they think that that's part of the problem. They can send you to discipline, which is, as a doc, you don't want to do, because discipline is where your license or your certificate of practice is really at risk. To fitness to practice, which is usually when there are some physical capacity issues. Sometimes physicians have been referred to the quality assurance program to do a more in-depth assessment of their practice. That's not happening anymore. Typically, the INR department is doing more in-depth assessments themselves. And we've got a new thing called a SCRP. SCRP stands for a Specified Continuing Education or Remediation Program. And basically, that means forced education. So typically, if we think that you need to be educated as a result of a public complaint, we'll try to get you to agree to do that through an undertaking. If you say, not going to do it, not interested, don't think that there's a problem, then the committee can force you and say you have to do this. And if you don't do that, then you go to discipline. So the committee can also issue cautions, which is sort of finger wagging, saying you should do this. Those can be in written form or in person. And they can also just offer advice, which is what counsel is. Okay, so that's all background stuff. Now we're going to get to some of the data. In your syllabus, you'll have these charts. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the charts. I'm going to get right to the I'm not going to spend time on the tables. I'm going to look at the charts, which show things a little bit better. So the blue bars throughout this are docs that are less than age 70, and the red bars are docs that are greater than or equal to 70. And what you'll see is that when there's been a complaint that's a clinical issue, and there's been some sort of an action required by the complaints committee, that's what this cohort of physicians are. There are more issues that are related to treatment, so that's currency of treatment, more issues that are related to prescribing of narcotics, that's the one that says prescribing ... prescribing in general as well. So they're prescribing issues generally in older physicians and treatment issues. And I think all of that to a certain extent deals with currency, staying up to date, that sort of thing. if we looked at the conduct issues by age, and I apologize, probably that label is not there that should be. It's the most important label there, too, because that label is professional communication. So conduct issues by age, when a complaint has been made and it's related to an issue of conduct, older physicians much more frequently have conduct issues related to unprofessional communication, ungovernability, or breaching of undertakings, and much less likely to be disruptive and having money issues, such as fraud. No more or less likely to have sexual impropriety issues. Everyone's equally likely to have sexual impropriety issues. And then we look at the capacity issues. This one is kind of interesting. Older physicians are less likely to have issues that are related to substance abuse, less likely to have issues related to psychiatric impairment, more likely, obviously, to have issues related to cognitive impairment, and interestingly, in this data set, less likely to have physical impairment. And again, you have to speculate why that might be the case, I think it might be the case that older physicians who've got a lot of physical or medical problems are more likely to be out of practice or not practicing. That's just speculating. So if we look at the committee decisions by age and what the committee has decided upon for these older physicians, it's much more likely if you're an older physician with a committee or with a complaint that leads to an action, much more likely that you're going to be referred to discipline. Much more likely that you will accept an undertaking, so you're not going to fight things. And much less likely to just be given advice by the committee. So that sort of suggests that the committee seems to be taking these issues more seriously in physicians over the age of 70. Whether or not they're biased because of the fact the physician is older than 70, I think is a reasonable thing to speculate. If you're over age 70, it's much less likely for the committee to take no action. If you're over the age of 70, it's much less likely for the department or the staff, meaning the investigator involved, to be able to resolve your complaint without it going to committee. And if you're over the age of 70, it's much less likely that the department or the staff will be able to close your file of your complaint for whatever reason. So the observations that I would make about the public complaints process that are related to age is that if you're over 70 and an action is necessary by committee because of a public complaint, it's more likely the complaints are related to treatment issues, to general prescribing and prescribing of controlled substances, to communications issues, to ungovernability, and to cognitive issues. These are the things that people are complaining about that are requiring action for physicians over the age of 70. In Ontario. But you're less likely to have complaints that are related to issues of confidentiality, fraud, disruptiveness, conflict of interest, substance abuse, mental health, and physical health problems. The committee decisions, if you're over the age of 70 compared to your younger peers, you're more likely to be referred to discipline or to sign an undertaking to restrict your practice or to do something that the committee would like you to do or not to do. But compared to your younger peers, you're less likely to have a no action, less likely to have a departmental closure, less likely to have resolution between parties before it gets to committee. So thing to think about for older physicians is that based on the peer assessment data and that of PrEP, older physicians are at risk of poor performance. So things to think about and that we'll talk about more in the workshops is should we be assessing these physicians routinely? I know that's something that we do, and it's something that is challenging to do, and it takes lots of resources, but it's something that we should think about doing. And we probably should think about doing that at younger than the age of 70. We use the age of 70. If you look way back to our peer data, you'll remember that really was a difference starting at age 55. So where that cutoff is, or if there a cutoff, or is like most things in life, there's probably a gradual progression of things. 70 is probably a bit old, and we've talked about this for a long time, whether we should bring that back. It's an issue of resources as well. So there's a lot more physicians practicing at 65 and 60 than there are at 70. And so this is an expensive program, as you might understand. And so to start doing at age 60 or 65 would be much more expensive. But this information also helps us to understand maybe what some of the educational needs are of this physician population. So maybe we should be encouraging and designing, developing, and implementing educational programs related to professional communication for older docs. I mean, you all know that communication styles are taught much differently now than they were in 1960 or 1970 or even 1980s when I went to medical school. Maybe we should be helping docs to learn a little bit more about professionalism and professional regulation. Maybe these docs should have specific educational programs developed to help them to stay up to date with current management principles, especially with prescribing and prescribing of controlled substance. And we also know that these docs are at risk for cognitive difficulties, and maybe we should be thinking more about the cognitive screening that we talked about earlier and whether that should be an important part even of MOL for older physicians. Okay. So as Dave alluded to, and for those of you that know me, the first question that's come to mind is, Bill, what's with the mustache? And so there's an initiative called Movember, which is a fundraising initiative. It takes place all over the world, actually. I think it's a bit more well-known in Canada than it is in the States, where men start clean-shaven at the 1st of November and then grow a mustache to raise money for prostate cancer and for men's health awareness. And I want to also thank Marc Biard, my colleague from Quebec, who's also sporting a mustache. He got a little bit late going, so his isn't nearly as unsightly as mine yet. It's actually kind of a fun thing to do. And I just want to congratulate this gentleman in the back here who's got he's got a mustache to be admired. Dare to dream. So if you get a chance, check out the Movember website, movember.com, you can search for me. And Mark, do you have a page on there as well? Do you have a site? Okay, so you can search for us, and you can even donate to us if you like. So anyway, I'm happy to take any questions. I think Andre is going to join us up here, and we'll answer any questions you might have about these programs that I think are a little bit different than what you do in the States. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joni Bomber. I am the director of the Physician Reentry Program that's affiliated with KSTAR at John Peter Smith in Fort Worth, Texas. And so we've been doing the remediation part, if you want, or the reentry part now for about 4 years. And one of the things that seems to me to be a theme in our group is isolation. And as I looked at the number of physicians practicing after the age of 65, there's a drop in the number of people practicing, even though it's increasing. And it raises the question in my mind about how isolated they are, whether in solo practice or not, and how much they actually can communicate with their peers as opposed to when they were younger. And it raises the question in my mind, having dealt with these older physicians on kind of an ongoing basis, about what is their connectiveness with other physicians who might be able to mitigate this effect that we see in the decline in their prescribing abilities and knowledge base and professionalism.
Part of the work that I do at the college is that I deal one-on-one with physicians who have been identified as the most severely discompetent. So those are the category fours and fives, and help them to develop education plans. And so if you look in my filing cabinet, in there are a bunch of struggling docs who are over the age of 55, they're male, and they're collegially isolated. Okay, so it's not just solo practice, it's collegially isolated. So that's what you're talking about. They don't have the opportunity, they don't have hospital privileges, they work on their own, there's no one down the hall that they can talk to. And these are the docs that get into the most difficulty. And so maybe we should be thinking about strategies when these docs are getting into difficulty as we do our screens of saying, you know what, if you want to keep on practicing, you got to get into a group practice. Right? You need to be working with someone on a regular basis. And our approach to remediating these docs is to get them working with peers in their practice. Okay, they have supervisors in their practice that help them to incorporate change into their practice. So that's a great observation that we can really learn from.
I agree with that, because we saw some older physicians, or, for example, surgeon, stop to do surgery in hospital and go to the walk-in clinic. They are isolated in their group because they are not in their peer. So a lot of examples like that. So I agree with Bill.
I might just add on a comment and perhaps a question, because we saw in Bill's data the professional communication issue, and makes me think of like the curmudgeon factor here, and how much that kind of falls into play, that maybe these folks that are professionally isolated are not around peers for a reason, and perhaps there's a way for us to identify those folks sooner and maybe get at them. And I don't know if you guys have had experience with that.
I just jumped because there was a question on the floor to Bill. What is the difference between the unconvertibility and disruptiveness? Because the link with that, some people we saw, they are disruptive physicians inside one establishment. And then the solution for that hospital is to kick out that physicians, but he's going another one and start the same process. So we decide to help them. So we put a workshop with Maggie Dupre, say, helping the hospital staff, the chief of staff, the head of the department, to deal with those disruptive physicians, because they become isolated inside because they are disruptive. So, Bill, what is the difference from unconvertibility and disruptiveness?
Okay, so I will try to answer that, although there are probably people in the room that will better answer that, because I don't work as much in the investigations and complaints side. But I think the ungovernability refers to docs that are before the college that essentially aren't cooperating with college processes, versus the disruptiveness, which typically is what's happening in the workplace environment. I just wanted to speak to Dave's comment about the old curmudgeon. I think that issue of professional communication, remember, came from patient complaints. So patients are complaining about older physicians that require an action. It's often related to communications issues, and I think we have to look at, we talk about patient-centered medicine. We need to talk about physician-centered assessment and regulation. And I think there's probably a reason why docs are curmudgeonly when they get older. Many of these docs are working but don't want to still be working. They might have to because of financial issues. There are docs that have changed their scope of practice. Ontario does have a scope of practice program now, so it's becoming less likely the case. But it used to be that a surgeon, if they had to retire in a mandatory way, they would just go and work in a walk-in clinic. And if you're a surgeon working in a walk-in clinic and you really don't know what you're doing, you're probably a little unhappy there. And so that might make you treat the physicians and be a little bit bitter. So this is all speculation, but it all speaks to the fact that we need to look at the big picture in terms of why people are behaving the way they're behaving. George, are you there?
Yeah, I'm George Carson from the Practice Enhancement Program in Saskatchewan. We modeled much of what we were doing on the peer assessment that Ontario was doing before. You described an interval for assessments that you said you hoped would be every 10 years. And my question is that chosen because that's what the resources permit, or is that chosen because there's evidence that that is an interval that appropriately correlates with performance?
Neither. So it's not what the resources permits. In fact, to assess every doc every 10 years will require significantly more resources, but that decision wasn't made based on resource needs. Nor I think, is there any good evidence to suggest that that interval is the necessary one. I think that, like many things in this area, that recommendation and desire was made based on consensus. Okay?
And reason. The so-called level three evidence stuff.
That's right.
Okay. Some comments quickly and then a question. First comment is that we, as a training program director, we look for curmudgeon surgeons. Just thought I'd make that mention. But seriously, the thing that gave me great heart in listening to both of you was the extraordinary high percentage, be they 60 or 70, who practice successfully or with minor change. So that goes against, I went to University of Chicago and the glass was always half empty, but I'm glad it's really half full and I'm delighted. But the question I would ask is, if you're worried about the over 70, and you are, why are we only looking at them every 5 years? Is that adequate for those risks? In other words, are there ways to identify or put up flags that they ought to be identified or looked at more frequently?
Well, certainly we would do it routinely every 5 years. What often ends up happening is that a dock is assessed, and about 20% of the docks will be category 2 or 3 in the peer assessment. So that means that 20% of those docks have something else happen. Okay, so they're on our radar screen. They often get involved in education programs. They might have to go on for a higher level of assessment. So we're not assessing and ignoring. We're assessing and assisting. And so for those docks that have been identified, could we do it more often? Absolutely, we could do it more often if our members were happy having their dues double or triple, right? So we already pay significantly more than you do as physicians, because this is all paid for by the physicians of the province of Ontario. This costs, physicians of the province of Ontario pay around $1,400, I think, a year in their registration, their membership dues, which is a lot more than many, many states. And so it's an expensive program. If we wanted to be assessing people more frequently, it would be a lot more expensive. So I think the question is whether we can develop other types of screens that could accomplish something similar to this on a more regular basis. And that I think that's a good question.
Excellent point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.